Okay, good morning, everyone. First of all, let me thank the organizers for inviting me to this very interesting workshop. It's a pleasure to be here. I was tasked to talk about laboratory experiments in plasma physics. I have to say from the beginning that I'm not an experimentalist. I do theory and simulations, but I work closely with experimentalists, and I enjoy that very much. And so I'll tell you a little bit about the work we've been doing using numerical simulations and laser-driven experiments to try to probe some of these microphysics of collisionless plasmas that could be relevant in astrophysical environments. So I'll start with a brief introduction and motivation for this type of studies. I'll then show you some recent work where it demonstrated the magnetic field amplification by the ion Weibull or current filamentation instability in the laboratory. I'll then discuss what's the current work in terms of generating relativistic paired flows from these laser plasma interactions. And I'll finish with some simulations based on these current parameters of beam plasma instabilities driven by these pair beams. So the underlying motivation for this type of studies is that kinetic plasma processes can be important in different astrophysical environments where we have collisionless plasmas, meaning that the Coulombian free path is much larger than the scales of the systems that we are dealing with. These are typically associated with environments where we have basically energetic plasmas or ejecta interacting with the ambient plasma environment. This is a classical picture of this fireball in the gamma ray burst, where it can have both internal shocks associated with shells with different velocities, or the external shock here when the edge of the ejecta interacts with the ambient medium. Also, you can think about supernova remnant shocks, for instance, or these AGN jets or blazers. The common aspect is that these sharp features that we observe here, they are much thinner than the Coulomb-mean free path in these systems. And so it must be collective plasma processes that can generate the strong fields that are required to slow down these flows and form these shock waves. And so we want to understand what are these processes that mediate the interaction of collisionless plasmas that can lead to formation of shocks or to the slowdown of these flows, and ultimately, for instance, to the acceleration of particles in these shock waves that require both waves in the upstream and turbulence in the downstream of the shock. And again, to understand this from first principles, we need to understand what are the kinetic physics involved in these environments. So that's kind of the motivation. Of course, which processes are going to dominate depend on the local plasma conditions. And so there's quite a large parameter range here if you think about astrophysical environments. Typically, for instance, when you talk about shock waves, but we can think about this just in terms of plasma instabilities as well, it's useful to think about magnetization versus the flow velocity, or in this case, the four momentum. So magnetization here is defined as the magnetic energy density divided by the kinetic energy density. And so we typically expect that in regimes where the ambient magnetic field is large, that will mediate the interaction. So for instance, for shock formation, we think about magnetic reflection, where the gyro radius of the particle is small, so the particles are, as they enter a magnetized region, they immediately slow down to form a shock. But at low magnetizations or high alphabetic Mach numbers, this changes. I mean, the magnetic field is not so strong anymore, and so you expect electrostatic and electromagnetic plasma processes to dominate the slowdown of these flows. If you think about this unmagnetized scenario, then you can think about different processes. This is a picture that we've seen already from Antoine and from his paper in 2010, where depending on the density ratio between the flow and the ambient plasma and the Lorentz factor of the flow, you can have different types of instabilities dominating. In particular, for alpha close to 1, we expect the Weibull or current filamentation instability to dominate. And here I'm going to use both terms interchangeably, even though originally they correspond to different instabilities from Weibull and Fried papers. And in the cases where alpha is on the order of 0.5 or lower, typically we have this oblique instability dominated. And so we want to understand, first of all, if we can confirm this, I mean, what instabilities dominate for which conditions, and also what happens beyond the linear regime, okay? How do these systems evolve when the goal is to understand how we can slow down completely these energetic flows, for instance, to form a shock, where you basically need to thermalize all these directed energy. And so the idea here is basically that by using first principle simulations, in particular with particle and cell codes, and laboratory experiments, we can try to bridge the gap between these astrophysical systems, where it's very hard to probe the local plasma physics, and having a better understanding of these kinetic processes. So the idea is that we use particle and cell simulations to try to model these things from first principles, and use those to design experiments where we can probe these physics. The code that I use in particular is OSIRIS 3.0, is a state-of-the-art massively parallel and relativistic peak code that has been developed for more than 15 years now from the OSIRIS consortium, which includes UCLA and IST in Portugal, where I did my PhD. I mean, the code has many important features. We have recently showed parallel scalability to 1.6 million cores in Sequoia, high-order splines, boosted frames, binary Coulomb collisions, different ionization modules, dynamic load balancing. A lot of these features are important when we are dealing with very long, large-scale simulations. To give you an example of this type of modeling that we are doing for this type of systems, here's a case of a relativistic shock formation, where basically we collide two relativistic electron-proton plasmas, and we try to understand, okay, what are the processes that lead to the slowdown of these flows and the formation of a shock. So I'm going to show you a movie here, and on the top we see the ion density evolution, in the middle the magnetic field component out of the plane. And so basically we have two flows, one moving towards this wall. We have a symmetric one in the opposite direction. I'm just showing you half of this symmetric system. And what we see is that as the flows counterstream, they are unstable to this current filamentation instability. You can see the clear development of the filamentation in density and magnetic field. You can think of basically this instability is the onset of the instability is when we have anisotropic distribution functions. And if you have basically a transverse perturbation in magnetic field in this case, that's going to pinch the currents locally. So this increase in the current is going to amplify the initial perturbation of the magnetic field. So we have a positive feedback loop. We have an exponential increase of the magnetic energy. And so you can see that you amplify strongly the magnetic fields here that will then deflect the incoming particles, slow them down to form a shock. You can see the shock front here moving to the left, from the left to the right. And so now if we track some of the most energetic particles in our system, what we find is that they are lucky enough to basically be trapped between the Weibull fields here in the upstream region and the turbulence that is generated in the downstream, so that they can cross the shock multiple times and gain energy. So if you look at the evolution of the spectrum in time here, we start with a Maxwellian that was basically, it's the incoming flow that was thermalized in the downstream, and then you see the development of this nice power law tail. I believe these are the largest simulations to date of these electron-proton plasmas, where we reach already 0.2 TeV, and our electrons start with 5 MeV. And all of this is done self-consistently, just starting with two cold plasmas counter-streaming with each other. And so this is some of the process that we would like to study in the lab one day, if possible. So when we think about that, we need to ask ourselves, does it make any sense to try to model these microphysics in the lab and make some connection with astrophysical environments? And I believe the answer is yes, if you think in terms of the local microphysics of the plasmas. I mean, we are not trying to put the gamma ray burst in a bottle. That's not the goal here. But if you look at two systems that share some assumptions, in particular that they are collisionless. As I said, the Coulombian free path is larger than the system size. In this case, initially magnetized, even though you can find similar scaling laws for magnetized systems, and that the flow velocity is larger than the thermal velocity, then basically your Vlasov-Maxwell system can be reduced to two dimensionless parameters. One has to do with the velocity of these flows. There's a gamma correction here if it's relativistic, and the other one has to do with the type of ion species that you have. And so two different systems, no matter if it's two different lab experiments or one in the lab, one in astrophysics, if they share these two parameters, they will have the same microphysics in terms of these assumptions. And so now we know how to scale things between each other. Basically, they scale with the square root of the density ratio. And so that means that in astrophysics, if your density is very low, you will have very low fields, very large spatial and temporal scales. In the lab, your density is much higher, so you will have much stronger fields, but much shorter scales. So that's kind of the motivation to try to do these experiments in a controlled way in the laboratory. So let me tell you about some of the work we've been doing in studying this current filamentation instability in collisionless counter-streaming plasmas. So the basic setup here for this type of experiments and simulations is quite simple in theory. So we have two foils, two plastic foils. We radiate those with kilojoules of energy in these 1 nanosecond duration lasers. Okay, and this experiment has been done at the Rochester Omega facility here in the US. So what these lasers are going to do is that they can have intensities on the order of 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 watts per square centimeter, so quite high intensities. They are going to basically ionize the surface of this material, create a plasma. They strongly heat the electrons to KeV levels. As the electrons try to escape into the vacuum, they are going to set up strong space charge fields that will bring the ions with them. And so effectively, you generate a flow that is moving away from the target. You can do this in a symmetric system, so we have two counter-streaming flows. Okay. The idea is that we use Thomson scattering to carefully characterize the conditions of this plasma. We show that in the interaction region here, we have flow velocities between 1,000 and 2,000 kilometers per second, temperatures on the order of 1 keV, densities on the order of 5 times 10 to the 18 particles per cubic centimeter. So you see immediately extremely high density. So expect the fields to be very high, the scales to be very small. The system size is about 8 millimeters. That's the separation between these two foils. And the Coulomb mean free path is larger than 7 centimeters. So we have more than 10 times the system size for your Coulomb mean free path. So that's what we want. We want to make sure that the interaction of these two flows is mediated by collisionless processes, not by collisions. So now what we ask ourselves is, okay, what field structures do we form? I mean, are these flows just crossing each other and nothing happens? Or do they excite strong fields when they do that? And so to probe the field structures, we use basically a control source of protons with monoenergetic energy. So all the protons have the same energy. They're going to traverse the interaction region. If there's no fields, we just collect a uniform basic fluence on or spatial distribution on the detector. If there's some strong fields, they're going to affect the structure of the protons, and so you will image that in this radiographic technique. So we use 3D particle in cell simulations to try to model this system one-to-one and to predict what kind of physics and what kind of fields we expect for these interactions. So these are actually 3D simulations, because if you want to compare this proton radiography diagnostic, we need to do 3D simulations. I'm showing you two movies here that are a slice basically at the axis of the beams. At the beginning, they are about to start interacting. That's the left flow, the right flow. This is the plasma density. This is the magnetic field out of the plane. If you wonder what these initial fields are, that's basically has to do with the fact that when your laser interacts with a foil, you have a source of magnetic field due to the Biermann battery, because you have misaligned density and temperature gradients, and so we want to take that into account. So just take into account that the fields are going to carry some fields with them. As you will show, that's not important for the physics we're trying to probe here. That's the physics of this filamentation instability, and we can clearly see it developing when these two flows interpenetrate. You can clearly see the formation of these filamentary magnetic fields from the Weibull or current filamentation instability that reached, for these laboratory conditions, values on the order of 20 Tesla. Okay? So that corresponds to more than 1% magnetization. So more than 1% of the kinetic energy density of the flows is converted into magnetic energy density. And so if this is true, I mean, we should expect to see that experimentally. I should also point out that you see that these initial Biermann battery fields, and that's the reason why we include them, they're kind of recompressed here at the interaction region. And so you have these two things on top of each other, the filamentation and these kind of two plates. So this is what we get experimentally. Have in mind that this is rotated 90 degrees from the previous simulation, so the flows are now moving like this. So we expect the filaments to be vertical. The first two rows are the experimental data for 3 MeV probing protons and 15 MeV probing protons. The last row is the 3D peak simulations for the same conditions for 15 MeV probing protons. And so in time, we can clearly see the evolution of this filamentation instability. You start with very small scale filaments, and then they grow to larger scales in time. We have a very similar evolution in our 3D peak simulations. Also, I should point out that these two stripes that you see here in the horizontal direction are exactly these Biermann battery fields that are recompressed that I showed in the simulation before. So we have done tests where we don't include those, and you see pretty much the same filamentation, but these two stripes disappear. And so this was very exciting. I mean, we were able to see for the first time the amplification of these magnetic fields through this ion current filamentation instability. And this was published in the beginning of last year here in Nature Physics. And we also looked at the evolution of this filament size. I should point out, if you look here at the structure of the filaments, they at late times, they're not so well ordered anymore. They start to become more tilted. That's typically what we see in this nonlinear regime already. And so also, you see clearly that the filament size is increasing. Again, that's what you expect in the nonlinear regime. So if you look at actually the growth rate or the inverse of the growth rate, the growth time, that's very small. That's on the order of a fraction of nanoseconds. So by the time we start probing here, we're probably saturated already. And we are seeing already the nonlinear evolution of the instability. We have now experiments planned to look at with finer temporal resolution at the earlier times. And so you see that the scaling of the growth of this filament size agrees pretty well between the simulation and experiments, even though there's kind of a 30% or so offset between the two. And so after doing this, also, I mean, from the fact that you have caustics in the radiographs, we can use that to infer what is the amplitude of the fields, and you get something like 10 Tesla, which again corresponds to on the order of 1% magnetization created by this instability. So the next step on this is we try to understand if we can actually see a fully formed shock mediated by this process. At omega, we cannot do that because we just have around 30 ion skin depths of interpenetration, and we typically need a few hundred for that. And so we have proposed an experiment for NIF, the National Ignition Facility in Livermore, which is the largest or the most energetic laser facility in the world. The idea is that if we have more laser energy now, we can have denser plasmas, so your skin depth becomes smaller. So in the same system, you can have many more skin depths, in this case, hundreds of them. So we have simulated this as well with these 3D simulations. It's an example, again, the density on top and the B field on the bottom. You can see as these two flows interact, not only they go unstable to this Weibull instability, but you see that if now you have a long interpenetration region, the fields are going to strongly affect the propagation of these flows. They're going to slow down, and you basically have two shocks that are generated and move away from each other. We can also see the transition from these well-defined filaments to turbulence in the downstream, as I showed you in these initial simulations as well. And so our hope is that with the experiments we are doing right now, we will be able to probe this shock formation for the first time. And a very exciting thing as well was that very recently, I was able to see for the first time that these non-relativistic Weibull-mediated shocks can be efficient particle accelerators as well, which is something that has not been seen before. It has been seen for a relativistic case, but not for the non-relativistic. And the main reason for that is the numerical artifact that I was talking about yesterday. I can talk more about it in the end if you are interested. But anyway, there's clear evidence that these shocks can accelerate particles. And so if we can see a shock in the lab, maybe there's hope to see also some non-thermal distributions. So this is what we've been doing with these non-relativistic electron proton flows or electron ion flows. Let me tell you a little bit about what's possible these days in terms of relativistic pairs. So the idea basically is that if we use this type of lasers, even though in this case same energy but much more intense, so they are shorter lasers on the order of picosecond duration, so we are talking about intensities of 10 to the 20 watt per square centimeter, so talk about teravolt per meter or per centimeters fields. What we can do now is to interact these lasers with IZ materials, gold. And what the laser is going to do is to basically accelerate electrons here at the surface to highly relativistic energies, let's say 100 MeV. Okay. Don't forget that these targets are very dense, so the laser cannot propagate, so it just interacts with the surface. And so you can imagine now having a source here of 100 MeV electrons that just propagates through the target. It's going to generate gamma rays from Bremsstrahlung. Okay, and these gamma rays are going to propagate through the target to produce pairs as they interact with the field of the nucleus of these gold ions. And so this is the Beta-Eitler process. It's not the Bright-Wheeler as you have in these extreme astrophysical environments, but the bottom line is that it's a mechanism for pair production, so you'll have copious amounts of pairs produced in this interaction. These pairs mainly come out as a beam in the direction of the laser on the rear side, okay? So if you look at terms of conversion efficiency, typically we have around 30% of the laser energy going into electrons, 10% of that, 1% goes to photons, and 10% of that goes to electrons and positrons. So we have about 3% of the laser energy going into these pairs. And so our team, in particular the team of Wei Chen, my collaborator at Livermore, has been doing experiments to probe this pair production scenario and to characterize these pair beams in different facilities worldwide. These are typically facilities where we have laser energies of 100, 1 kilojoule in this picosecond or 10 picosecond duration. So in particular, we did experiments at Titan in Livermore, Omega, I just told you about it, in Rochester, Orion in UK, and LFX in Japan. So these are quite big facilities to host these lasers, even though the experiment is actually very, very small. And so what the team of Wei has done was basically to irradiate these gold foils, typically millimeter thickness, with these high-intensity lasers, and then they have different spectrometers at different angles that they use to characterize the electron, positron, and proton distribution, and also I-gamma ray diagnostics. So let me give you a little bit of a flavor for the type of features that we can probe in this electron-positron plasma. So here's the spectrum of the positrons that come out, that they are collected in the rear side, so in the direction of the laser. This is three different energies, 250 joules, 800 and 1.5 kilojoules. You can see that these are quite peaked distributions, which are great if we want to study these relativistic beam plasma instabilities. The peak energy increases with the laser energy. The typically Lorentz factor of these flows is between 10 and 100, so 5 to 50 MeV, and the temperature is on the order of 0.1 to 1 MeV, so I would say that these are quite in the range that we would like to have to probe this physics of the relativistic beams interacting with an ambient medium. An important issue was, what is the scaling of the number of positrons with laser energy? How can we increase the number of positrons? And so we recently found that the scaling is quadratic with energy, which was very exciting. And so for current laser energies, which are on the order of 1 kilojoule, we can have pair beam densities on the order of 10 to the 14 to 10 to the 15 particles per cubic centimeter. In the future, as lasers approach 10 kilojoules, we would expect to increase this number by 100. Two important issues apart from the spectrum and the number of particles have to do with the collimation or the divergence of these beams and with the charge neutrality. This can be an issue if you don't do anything. If you just shoot the laser on the foil, typically you get a divergence angle on the order of 30 degrees, which is quite large. You have a lot more electrons than positrons because these lasers, remember, are producing these copious amounts of electrons, and only a fraction of those will convert into gamma rays and then electron-positron pairs. And so what my colleagues have done experimentally recently was to use this 10 Tesla field from a coil to basically do energy selection and collimation of these beams. And you can show that, so these are the results without collimation. This is the electron spectrum and this is the positron spectrum. You can see that it's much broader and you have a lot more electrons. When you use this magnetic field, you can see that now they are much closer to each other. They're both quite narrow. You measure a lot more positrons or electrons in your solid angle because basically the divergence is also much smaller. And so basically with this technique, we can decrease the divergence full width of maximum angle to 4 degrees and the ratio of electrons to positrons to 2.5. That's still not ideal. You would like that to be 1, but it's much closer, and we think that we can improve this to make it 1. That's what we're trying to do now. I should say that there's different approaches that people have been looking at, in particular this group at Belfast. The basic idea is the same. The difference is that instead of using the laser to interact directly with a solid target, they have a gas jet before that they use to generate relativistic electrons from this laser wake field acceleration. Okay, so basically they produce here, let's say, 200, 300 MeV electron beams that are then interacting with a solid target and producing the radiation, and then the radiation produces the pairs. Okay, what are the main differences? Well, these beams, they are very short and very narrow, okay, typically like 15 femtoseconds and few microns transversely, instead of 10 picoseconds and millimeters as we have in the direct laser case. They also show much higher energies. You can see here the spectrum measured in the solid line above 200 MeV. In dashed are the simulations. They measure 3 times 10 to the 7 pairs. They then extrapolate this based on the simulations to a total number of 10 to the 9. I think there's a big but here. I mean, to me, it's not so obvious that you can just extrapolate this all the way to the low energies. So I have some issues with these results. Anyway, I wanted to show them to you. In terms of the ratio, they show, again, based on this assumption, which to me has its limitations, they show that they can produce charge-neutral beams. And so if that's true, that's fantastic. Okay. So of course, that's a big advantage. I would also point out that this spectrum is exponential, so it's monotonic decaying, so that's probably not very ideal for some of these instabilities. But in any way, they claim to have charge neutrality, which is, of course, very important. And so based on these numbers, we can think of different experiments that we may start to be able to do now or in the next 1 or 2 years. One, of course, is just to have generate 2 of these pair beams and collide them with each other and try to probe instabilities mediated by the counterstreaming of these relativistic pair beams. Okay, this could be relevant, for instance, to the physics of internal shocks, where we expect different shells of electron, positron, plasma to collide with each other. In these scenarios, we expect this Weibull or current filamentation instability to dominate. This is the growth rate that you expect. And so if you plug in some numbers, kind of on the optimistic side for what is possible right now, 10 to the 15 particles per cubic centimeter for the density of these pairs, and gamma on the order of 10. The transverse size of this beam, and I'm here using the numbers from this laser, from the direct irradiation of the laser in on the foil to produce the pairs, it's on the order of 1 millimeter. So that corresponds to 2 cn omega p, where this is already corrected for the relativistic Lorentz factor on the electron mass. And so this is quite marginal, okay? We have two skin depths, so maybe you can see some filaments. I'll show that it's probably possible, even though it's quite marginal. The duration of this beam is on the order of 10 picoseconds, so that corresponds to 8 growth times. So in principle, we can study the linear phase of the instability with current conditions. As I mentioned, I mean, if in 5 years or in a couple of years we have 10 kilojoule lasers, which actually we have one right now in Livermore that was just developed, even though the duration is still too large for what we want, these numbers would improve dramatically. Another possibility that is more relevant to the discussion here is that we can simply propagate one of these beams in an ambient plasma. We can have a hydrogen gas that we ionize. We have controlled background density that we can tune. And so you have basically this electron positron beam propagating in electron proton background. In this case, as we've seen in the last 2 days, we expect this oblique instability to be the dominant one, at least in the linear phase. And so again, if you plug in some numbers here, the same assumption as we have here for the beam, again, we see that now the transverse size, there's a 1 over square root of alpha. So the larger the density, or the smaller the density ratio, meaning the denser the background, the better. In terms of the beam duration, we will have several omega p inverse, so that should be okay. And if we think that for this 4-degree full width of maximum divergence, we can with confidence propagate these beams over a couple of centimeters without losing too much in density, then let's say here for 1 centimeter, you expect the interaction time to be of a few tens of growth times. So in principle, you can even approach the nonlinear regime of the instability.
Yes. So that's the code for a frame. Is this the right condition for that beam?
Sorry?
That's the code of
the Yes, right? Yes. For these temperatures between 0.1 and 1 MeV, okay. I've done simulations and the results 0.1 or 1 are very, very consistent. So it seems that the cold limit is a good approximation. So that's what we're going to try to test with some simple simulations, even though I should warn you again that at this stage we don't have a charge neutrality of 1, which we are assuming in the simulations. This is an important step at the experimental level. Okay, I think there's well-defined strategies to clean up these beams, but I just wanted to point that out. And so here's an example where we just collide these two electron positron pair beams. Again, for the current scales, we don't expect a lot, but it seems like we are able to look at the linear phase. So this is the positron density, the electron density looks the same, and the B field out of the simulation plane. In this case, we have a Lorentz factor of 12. They are about to start interacting here. They are overlapping here. It's hard to say, but you start to see some level of magnetic field there. And by the time they are about to leave each other, you can see already a very well-defined filamentary mode associated with a wibble. Again, we have two wavelengths, basically. That's what you expect, so it's in good agreement with the theory. And you reach already very strong magnetic fields, again, on the order of 10 tesla. So that's exciting, because that means that if we measure 10 tesla fields with this technique before, we can use exactly the same technique to probe these fields. These are millimeter scale, so in principle, we can radiograph these fields. We also see that as the beams leave, there's no plasma in the background, so the fields are kind of following the beams and being a bit compressed. But so the bottom line is that in principle, based on these current parameters, we could start to study the linear phase of this current filamentation instability in counter-streaming relativistic pair beams. Now, regarding the case of the oblique instability, the results that we are seeing also seem to matched pretty well what we were expecting. So here's again our electron positron beam that is propagating to the right. Notice that the scales are changing here. This is the longitudinal electric field and the perpendicular magnetic field. We can clearly see the development of the oblique instability, both in the density and in the field structure. The direction of the K is close to 45 degrees, and it's aligned with the electric field pretty much. We also see that the size of these filaments or these modes is increasing in time, and that the electric field dominates over the magnetic field, particularly at later scales. At later times. This is done for an alpha of 0.1, so the beam density was 10 times smaller than the background density. If you look at the evolution of the energy in the field and the particles, we see that the linear phase matches reasonably well the linear theory, where you expect this growth rate here. We also see that most of the energy is in the electric field. Here we have the parallel and perpendicular components, and we have much smaller energy on the magnetic field, as you expect for the oblique instability. And also by the end here, we have about 16% of energy loss of the electron positron beam that goes mostly into the background. Okay. And so apart from radiographing the fields, we can think of an easy way to look at these processes, which is to basically do an experiment where you just propagate this beam in vacuum, you measure its spectrum, and then you do different experiments where you have this background plasma with different lengths, and you see as a function of the propagation distance what is the change in the spectrum of this beam.
How big was your box for this simulation?
So this box is I think it's on the order of 1,000 C and omega P of the background. In the longitudinal direction, I think 300 something. I think 360 in the transverse direction. And so here's the evolution of the spectrum. In black, you have the initial one. You see that by the end of the linear phase, near saturation, as you expect, the spectrum didn't change much. Okay, you put energy mostly in the fields. But after that, in the nonlinear phase, you see a strong slowdown of the beam. And so if you look at centimeter scale propagation distances, you can see this is quite visible. And so in principle, if you can do this experiment, you would be able to measure clearly the slowdown or the spectral modification of the beam associated with the development of these instabilities. We run a similar case for the alpha of 0.01. So in this case, the electron positron beam is always the same. I'm just changing the background density, making it more dense. In this case, 100 times denser. Again, even though the resolution of the diagnostic here is not great, the growth rate seems to be relatively in good agreement with the theoretical one. Now you can see that the energy is lost, as you expect also, is not so strong. We had about 9% energy lost after 2,000 omega p inverse. And again, it's mostly, in terms of fields, it's mostly in the electrostatic component, as you would expect. Also, you can see that because the instability is not so strong, as you increase the density ratio, or you decrease the density ratio, you can see that even though I think this is measurable, it's much smaller now, the slowdown of the beam after a couple of centimeters. Okay. But the bottom line is that I think that what these simulations are showing is that if you can make these beams for the current conditions but charge neutral, you could do this simple experiment of propagating them in the background plasma and radiographing the fields and seeing how the spectrum changes as a function of propagation distance to try to understand what exactly can we expect from these type of instabilities in the nonlinear regime to slow down these beams. And so let me conclude here. I've tried to convince you that collisionless plasma processes can provide quite rich physics environments where kinetic plasma physics can be important. And this is true in laboratory for sure, but we also think that it's true in astrophysical environments. These high energy density laser-driven plasmas offer a unique tool to probe this physics in collisionless plasmas. We have already demonstrated through experiments and numerical simulations that this current filamentation instability can convert at least 1% of the kinetic energy density of these beams into magnetic energy density. And so we are now developing the experimental and modeling platforms to study these four relativistic pair plasmas as well. And so my hope is that in the next 5 years or maybe 10 years, we can use these platforms to answer some of the critical open questions that have to do with the nonlinear development of these plasma instabilities. Also, I'm particularly interested in shocks. We want to understand what is the field structure of collisionless shock waves, how does that depend on the environment conditions, and what determines the onset of turbulence and particle acceleration in shocks. Finally, I'd like to acknowledge my collaborators, in particular the experimental team at Livermore that, with whom I've been working on these experiments, and also the team of Anatoly Spitovsky that has also been involved in modeling some of these experiments and these plasma effects in general. Also the use of OSIRIS from the OSIRIS Consortium, use of different supercomputers, and financial support as well. Thank you very much for your attention.
In the simulation that you showed for the building, what was the temperature in the background? And the reason I'm asking is that if the background, if you start with the whole background, the linear Landau damping start competing in the against the growth rate in the unstable region. What was the temperature of the thermal spread?
So the ions were cold, completely cold. In the electrons, I think, if I remember correctly, I think the V thermal was something like 10 to the minus 4. So it's very cold.
Minus 4 C.
Yes. So I'm assuming a cold background. It's probably not going to be 10 to the minus, but actually can be. I mean, if you have, in the experiment, if you have a gas and you just use some ionizing radiation just enough to ionize the gas, you can have extremely small temperatures in your plasma that you create.
So this is also accessible?
Yeah. You can control depending on how much energy you use to ionize this gas to create the plasma.
Yeah. Your frequency was mainly electrostatic, so how sensitive is photon radiography to sensing electric field versus magnetic?
So that's a very interesting question. So of course the protons will see both electrons and electric fields and magnetic fields. What it's very interesting about our diagnostic is that we have two energies. Okay, so we have 10 eV and 15 MeV, and that allows you to break the degeneracy between electric fields and magnetic fields because the deflection goes with 1 over energy for the electric field and 1/√ of energy for the magnetic field because of the V cross B term in the Lorentz force. And so basically that's what we did for the Weibull experiment as well, to show that those fields are magnetic fields and they cannot be explained by electric fields. Okay, so basically what you need to have two energies and compare the structures in the two energies, and that in principle will allow it to discriminate if it's electric field or magnetic field that is producing the deflections.
And then you're basically imaging the instantaneous electric field of the Langmuir wave that mediate the instability, basically, right? I guess the proton pulse is short enough to do that. Right?
That's a good question. So the duration can be on the order of tens of picoseconds. So you, in that sense, it for these short time scales, it would be kind of time integrated. So you would have to take that a little bit into account. So I would say that the duration of the proton source would be comparable to the duration of these beams. Okay. But you do local measurements, so you know exactly where the field is coming is.
Great talk. are any perspectives to actually look at homogeneities in the background? Could you think of sort of setting up into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think that's the easiest part. I think once you have your positron electron beam with charge current neutral, then I think there's possibilities to do that. Yeah, I mean, we can think about using foams, for instance, that have in themselves large inhomogeneities. You can think what people do sometimes, because sometimes it can be tricky to have large volumes filled with gas. Is that they have a second target that they so you have your main target here where you produce the jet, and then you have another one here that you ablate. And so in this case, typically we have a transverse density gradient, but you can, I mean, depending on how far you put this target, it can make it almost flat. I mean, there's ways of controlling that. I think that would be okay. You can also think of putting two gas jets that have a small apertures that kind of have higher density and lower, and then higher density again. I think one can be creative about
that. Just play the rock and roll lab. You generate a background of sound waves, which surely have the sound speed's much lower than the beam speed, right?
So yeah.
That would be fun. Yeah. You could say, what is your favorite rock and roll band that you're putting on there?
I mean, in theory, that's the beauty of this, that you can control the parameters and try to see and see how that affects the interaction.
Could you also make it be warm?
I mean, I don't think we have a lot of control over that. I mean, you have basically, at least from studies that I've done so far, it's kind of what you have here. As you increase the energy, you increase the laser energy. You increase the mean energy of the beam, and also its temperature. Even though the temperature is always between 0.1 and 1 MeV for these experiments, so there's some relation there to the beam to the laser energy that I'm not sure you can control that too much experimentally.
I believe there was one last question.
Yes. Thank you. Why is it an experimental challenge to obtain a neutral parabeam?
Because the of course there's two parts. One is, of course, the pair production. I mean, part is clear, right? You produce the same amount of electrons and positrons. However, you start from a bath of electrons alone that were produced by the laser. And so only a small fraction of those lead to the generation of radiation, then a small fraction of those lead to generation of pairs. So you always have this background of relativistic electrons that were initially produced by the laser. Okay. On top of that, at the rear side of the target, as you have these electrons that are in large number leaving, you generate space charge fields, okay? And the space charge fields, of course, are going to affect electrons and positrons differently, okay? They're going to accelerate positrons, decelerate electrons. And so there can be some variations in the spectrum and in the number due to these effects, okay? So this is something that people are trying to control, both using these magnetic fields to do energy selection and collimation, but also playing with the thickness of the target. So this is ongoing work on the experimental level.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.